Everybody, it's Alan back with Medical Monday, Vox Pop's WAMC live afternoon call-in talk show. In the studio today on the Medical Monday is Dr. Paul Singh, the Director of Bariatric Surgery at Albany Medical Center. Specializing in laparoscopic and minimally invasive procedures, Dr. Singh is widely recognized for his expertise in robotic gastric bypass surgery, lap banding, and other general surgery in the field of gastroenterology. Dr. Singh completed his medical training at the University of Pittsburgh and completed his internship and residency at New York Medical College in Valhalla, New York. Dr. Singh has been at Albany Medical Center since 1993, where his bariatric surgery department has the distinction of a Level 1 accreditation, a Level 1A accreditation from the American College of Surgeons for offering lifelong support to bariatric surgery patients. So, you can call us at 1-800-348-2551. You heard it, 1-800-348-2551. You can also comment on the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us. And this is the important one as far as I'm concerned, as a 72-year-old speaking. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, we have a terrific program today, and the phones are beginning to light up. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. But before we do, let's talk to Dr. Singh for a moment. Doctor, first of all, congratulations on all your achievements at the medical center.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you for having me here today.
Okay, and number two. Bariatric surgery, I have several friends who've had it. Some are what they call banded, meaning they put a band on, which is adjustable, right? And then the second part is, stapled, so that once you have it, that's sort of it. Am I wrong about any of that?
Well, I think that's one way to think about it. We think of it that it wants you to make a decision about bariatric surgery. You should think of it as a one-way commitment that you're going to continue to do all the things to help yourself lifelong. So whether it be banded or bypass or sleeve, you're making a fairly significant commitment to making significant changes lifelong to keep your weight under control and your health better.
But what do you do? I mean, what you say is exactly spot on, because I've known people who, the ice cream goes down easy, and you really have to be committed to the concept of weight loss, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Whether it be banding or bypass, or whether it be just diet and exercise, all these things take a commitment, and that's always the hardest part, is to stay committed.
Yeah.
Banding and bypass and sleeve help you reassure some of that commitment, but they do come with sort of trade-offs. So it is important that you understand what your commitment is and you be willing to stay with it lifelong.
Right. So you've done a couple today, right, already?
Yeah, actually, we did three today.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And how long does an average operation take?
Well, an average operation can take anywhere between an hour to an hour and a half. Sometimes if it's complicated, it can be 3.5 hours. Fortunately, today things were not complicated, so they're a little bit on the shorter end of things, an hour, hour and a half or so.
So these are robotic, if I'm reading this right. I had minimally invasive back surgery. This is minimally invasive bariatric surgery, right?
Yes it is.
So how do you do it? You got a big screen up there, and then your hands are on the Nintendo controls.
Yeah, everyone thinks that we bring the robot in and it does everything by itself, and we stand back and just watch it work. Yeah. Unfortunately, not there yet. We sit at a controls console right next to the patient, and the robot then manipulates its tools by the way what we do. So we control the robot to make every action and movement. It makes us more precise, better vision, better outcomes for patients. So that's why we chose to use the robot.
And the robot has the advantage, if I understand this correctly, of not messing with the muscles the way if somebody's hands were inside of a patient.
With the robot, we can use minimally invasive techniques where we use smaller incisions, smaller sites to enter into the abdomen to do the same operation that would have involved in a full length of the abdomen incision. Now we can do through 3 or 4 little holes about half an inch in size.
Wow. Now on banding, let me see if I got that one right. If you go in and somebody is banded, meaning they put a band around the stomach, mm-hmm. If it's not working, you can either let it out or pull it in, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of banding is sort of like that extra tight belt or that extra tight corset that you wear.
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't like how much is going through, you tighten it up a little bit and it feels tighter and you can't expand your stomach as much, or you can't expand, so therefore you're full. And then if you're not, if it's too full or too tight, you can relax it. So it gives you some variability of how you can tighten or loosen things to allow food to go in.
Psychologically, though, it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, that if you're banded as opposed to stapled, you know, you can cheat a little bit more easily.
I think people think of that way, since there is that variability that you can change and you can always make changes, that I can do a little bit less today, cheat a little bit more, and then later on I can make up for it and have that happen. So there is a lot of psychology involved with people who have bands and some of the things that they need to change to do.
Okay, so we're going to start with the phones. Are you ready, doctor?
I am.
Okay, we'll go to Linda in Queensbury. Linda in Queensbury, you're on. Hello, Linda. Whoa, maybe something ain't right. Maybe something is. We'll see. Okay, Linda, I think Linda may be listening to the radio, but I'll tell you what her question was. You can keep her open there, Zach. I'll tell you what the question was. Hannah did a terrific job of letting us know. And the question is there a point at which, an age at which, bariatric surgery is not recommended?
Well, there are recommendations by national organizations about bariatric surgery for people who are usually over 18, and then coming up to about 65 to 70 years of age. We look at individuals from their physiologic age, so someone who may be looking 70 may look like 50 and may be still a candidate for it. So people who are within the normal range, as it were, 18 to 65, probably no real restrictions. People at the fringes of under 18 and over 65, some real case-to-case variability, and really requires, you know, evaluation prior to saying yes or no.
Well, the one under 18 thing is particularly interesting. You know, women and men feel sometimes that, you know, life would be very different if they didn't have that additional weight.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me you've got to be part psychologist in order to properly evaluate something like that.
There is some significant issues for people under 18 about psychological counseling and also follow-up care, and the ability to cheat, as it were, in what they do, so that the outcomes may not be as successful. So therefore, going through a bigger operation and not getting a successful outcome because of the psychology.
Do you find yourself saying no a lot?
We say no as well as we say yes. And it's really, we're looking at the overall health for the patient and what the best idea would be long term. And sometimes it's surgery and sometimes it's medical management.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And we'll go now to, we hope, Donna in West Shokan. Donna in West Shokan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I have a 22-year-old daughter who is about 5 inches tall. And over the last few years, she's been steadily increasing. Her weight's been steadily increasing. She now weighs about 240 pounds. She has approached me in discussion about having lap band surgery, but she has never really tried anything on her own to change her eating habits, exercise, lifestyle. And the approach that I've taken with her is to try to encourage her to do those things seriously before she considers the surgery. My specific question is, do you think that that's an important approach? And do you think that this would, number one, help her be more successful? And do you think it would lead to a longer-lasting, healthy weight?
Well, I think you've asked a couple of good questions, and the questions sort of look at, one, what's the real benefit of surgery, and where does all these other components fit in? And we always start with that the first three things you have to do if you're going to think about your weight is make changes in your diet, changes in your exercise, changes in your lifestyle management, stress management aspects of life. Those are the three components that always have to be in place before we even think about surgery or where we go.
So, I agree.
So if someone were to come see us, we would talk about maximizing those benefits first and then seeing what the changes would occur. So we look at manipulating the diet, making good choices, eliminating sugar content, eating things that are more healthy in nature, more filling, protein-based diets, other things that will help the diet to stay full and not have problems from that standpoint. And obviously that evil word exercise fits in the picture, and everyone has to do it. And it's always important to do, but doing it correctly and not wasting time exercising and spending more time futilely trying to do something more than you should is what we look at. And obviously lifestyle management. And those three things could make significant changes first. And if they do, then surgery never would raise its head. If it doesn't, then if those things are in place, surgery makes a big benefit for that. But it comes, again, with trade-offs.
Donna, you sound like a wise woman. We're going to let you go because we got to take
Thank
a little
you.
Break here. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Bye now.
Okay, so we'll take maybe 7 seconds. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Skidmore College Master's Program, offering customized graduate programs in the liberal arts and sciences through part-time interdisciplinary study, MALS at skidmore.edu. St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, celebrating 100 years serving the healthcare needs of the community, including the Red L Cancer Care Center, emergency and trauma care, and advanced robotic surgery, sfhospital.org. Bow Wow Bathhouse Resort and Daycare, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, for over 7 years providing 10 hours of daily indoor-outdoor play, professional grooming, and retail shop. TheBowWowBathhouse.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. And PS21 Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York. Presenting Pearson Woodrigg Dance Theater, performing ordinary festivals and new works on August 16th and August 17th at 8 p.m. PS21Chatham.org.
All right, we're going to Ken in Durham, New York. Okay, Ken, you are now on the air, but not before I say 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Ken, you're on.
Hello.
Ken, go.
Hi. I'm inquiring about hiatal hernia, and wondering if the doctor has an opinion on the wisdom of surgery for that problem. It's something that's been bothering me for over 10 years, and my gastroenterologist has told me more than once that... generally not worth surgery because it's somewhat complicated and often ineffective, the surgery that is. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Well, there's a lot of different issues to hiatal hernia, and there's a lot of opinions that are not what they used to be, say, 10, 15 years ago, where a lot of people base their facts. Hiatal hernias are a fairly complicated picture in what kind of symptoms and problems and what they cause. And if they're causing you symptoms and problems, there are treatments for them that can involve surgery that can have outcomes that are fairly predictable and can be good. Now, there are issues where people have hiatal hernias which don't cause any symptoms, or issues where surgery can make that anatomy better, but it may not make you feel better physiologically. It may not be an improvement from that situation. So I think it never hurts anyone to sort of hear all sides of it. And if your gastroenterologist is... not interested in you having it repaired, is to hear whether for you it might be a good choice or not. And again, that depends on a lot of your symptoms, a lot of your anatomy, a lot of problems that have happened. And I think it's too complicated over the radio for me to give you a yes or no or thumbs up or thumbs down, but there definitely are treatments for it, and there definitely are now minimally invasive approaches that are not what they used to be 10, 15 years ago.
That's interesting. You know, Ken, many of us have hiatal hernias. I'm one of them. And, you know, we all have taken various medicines that, you know, keep the gastric juices lower and the rest of it. We know that. On the other hand, we don't really know, is this right, doctor, exactly what they do to us. We have a feeling that I mean, there have been some studies that have suggested some very bad things can happen when, like me, you take this stuff all over your life.
Yeah, I mean, there are... now a lot more associations for, you know, with the proton pump inhibitors, which are the drugs that mainly reduce your acid, you know, were originally only supposed to be used for 6 months and then stopped.
That. I was on those.
And so, you know, whether you absorb calcium as well, whether you leads to more potential infections, pneumonias, other issues, there's multiple studies that show that these complications or issues are starting to happen more frequently than we used to not think of.
Well, except that the one we all worry about is what our parents would call the big CA.
Yep.
Is that, has that been associated? With lowering the continued use of the proton pump?
No, usually, you know, most people who would develop cancer issues, you know, Barrett's esophagus is the term that people look at first as a pre-malignant lesion. Most of those things would be because of ongoing acid reflux. And you can be on PPIs and still have acid reflux and still not be protected from it. That's where, you know, gastroenterologists, surgeons, other people would recommend surgery for you to have that done.
Right.
So there's a spectrum of disease, and depending on where you are in the spectrum, you can move to the right or to the left of the spectrum, depending on what therapies you'd want to do.
Well, while we're on with Ken, the then question is, if you have Barrett's, you know, and it's checked all of the time, but if it gets out of hand, what is the procedure? Isn't there some kind of ablation or something like that you can do?
Well, recently in the last five to seven years, there's ways to actually ablate or remove that lining of your esophagus and have it regrow and hopefully not come back as Barrett's. And it's a new therapy which changes the curve of how the disease is treated. Unfortunately, if you still have reflux, you can still, 2 or 3 years down the road, develop Barrett's again.
Yeah.
So that's why most people believe treating the disease more definitively by surgery or some means where you eliminate the chance for it to come back in combination with ablation is probably a better long-term solution, and especially for someone who's 30 or 40 who has it, who's looking at a lifetime of another 30, 40 years, might be something to consider as opposed to a PPI every day, which may not be successful at that time.
Do you personally do ablation?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And again, what is it you peel off the internal lining?
It's actually the lining of your esophagus. There's a radio frequency type catheter that's placed into the esophagus. And that actually, like getting a big sunburn to the first layer of your esophagus. And that sunburn causes that lining to peel off. And then when it regrows, hopefully the Barrett's tissue is not regrown into the tissue that's there.
I remember you and I once talked about that. Thank you very much. Ken, that was a great call. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay. Let's go to Ingrid in Lake George. Okay, Ingrid, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me on. Doctor, I was just wondering, I'm a women's health nurse practitioner, and I do see some patients that have had lap band surgery and are extremely happy with it, most of the patients, if you will. And you had mentioned the diet, the exercise, and the psychological component, but I noticed that the psychological component is a really big aspect to this before and after the surgery. So I was wondering your approach before the surgery, if they meet someone or they just speak with you, and also after the surgery, if they're followed up in that regard, as far as, you know, the overeating, what caused the overeating, and if they sort of get to the root of the cause of why they overate in the first place. So I'll hang up and listen to your
No.
Okay.
We never do it that way.
Okay.
Go ahead, doctor.
Thanks for the question. It is and like any of our bariatric procedures, people go through extensive psychological counseling even before they have the surgery. We want to first make sure that they don't have any psychological issues like bulimia, anorexia, other eating disorders that may cause problems after the surgery, and also come to some of the root of the problems that they may have that lead them to have the issue, whether it is overeating, whether it is stress management, other things that come to it. Because once you place a new stress on someone, whether it be banding or bypass or anything else, unless those coping mechanisms are in place, they're going to develop new bad habits or new habits that come from there. And hopefully the new habits they learn are actually good habits so that they will continue to do well long term. But we do recognize that they are going to have issues. And we recognize as we change the band size and do things, we make people, instead of being able to eat off a full menu, they can only eat off one third of the menu. And when you can only eat off one third of the menu, how will you feel and what will you be able to do going to a nice restaurant and being able to only pick from the one third of the menu has effects on people and does have effects. And that happens mainly, we see, in people who have banding. And it is an issue that we obviously long-term want these people to recognize and be able to deal with.
Do you ever send, following up on Ingrid's very good question, do you ever send anybody, you have a very good psychiatric department and mental health department at Albany Med, do you ever send people there?
Absolutely. Everyone gets preoperative or as they enter the program, they get counseling. They see a psychiatrist, psychologist. They see them as frequently or as many times as they need to. And we believe in lifelong follow-up with it. So not only just to see them once or talk to me once and get my issues, but talk to me as many times as I need to and follow me up long term so that I will have all the care that I need from that component of it.
Well, Ingrid, anything else?
No, thank you so much, and I was very happy to hear your response. I really appreciate it. Very interesting.
Thank you very much, Ingrid.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
Your chances of getting to talk to the doctor about things bariatric are 100%. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Don't kick yourself tonight when lying in bed and said, I should have called him, and I have this question, but I just didn't want to. These are all anonymous calls. You don't have to. Nobody uses their name, so just do what you want. 1-800-348-2551. So, if we are talking bariatric, is there a worry that you have a lot of responsibility that if you say no, you could do some real damage to a patient?
I think the when we say yes and we say no, we change people's lives from what they can or will be able to do and what will happen. So saying no is something that we don't think of as saying no. We think of, as people come into our program, we think of things as a spectrum of treatment. And the spectrum of treatment starts with medical management, and it could be diet, exercise, and lifestyle, and that may be all that they need. The spectrum could continue to being medications. And when we add medications in, we don't get rid of diet, exercise, or lifestyle. So
I don't know what you said, but all five phones are ringing now.
So I think what happens next is then surgery gets added in, but we never let go of someone in their lifelong follow-up with us. So it's not that one treatment is the only option. There are multiple options, and so no is not a word we usually use a lot of.
Cool. Let's go to Jerry in Northampton, Massachusetts. Jerry, are you there?
I am here.
Good. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thanks, Alan. First-time caller, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome, and we encourage you to do it again. Go ahead.
All right. You were talking earlier with the doctor about Barrett's esophagus and the ablation technique.
Yep.
So I've had a relative who had Barrett's esophagus, had the ablation at least once, and the lesions or whatever kept coming back. And so his doctor suggested that they remove the esophagus, and they stretch the stomach or kind of staple it up further. I don't know what they're stapling it to, but what happened is he had that procedure done, and then apparently the little bit of his windpipe or whatever it is that you attach the stomach to, there's still some whatever Barrett's stuff there. So it seems like he did the whole procedure for nothing, and I'm wondering if this is a normal thing that happens sometimes or if this is a freak accident. And it's a horrible story when I heard it, so I'm wondering what the doctor might have to say.
Let's hear it. Doctor?
Well, as I said, Barrett's esophagus comes in a variety of different, disease states. And it can be from simple Barrett's esophagus to more complicated Barrett's esophagus, which is a pre-malignant or a truly malignant lesion.
Right.
It sounds like your relative actually had a malignant form of Barrett's in the sense that it required a resection of that esophagus. And to reconnect the intestinal tract back together, they connected a part of his esophagus to his stomach, which is a treatment that happens when someone has a malignant form of the Barrett's or has a more invasive form of Barrett's. So what we were talking about before is preventing getting to that point. Now, there are groups of people who have Barrett's, so that does get that far, who have invasive type disease where they need more aggressive treatments. And then once that does happen, it is possible because of the connection between the esophagus and the stomach, and there is no muscle to hold acid in the stomach, that acid will then freely flow back in the esophagus and cause more Barrett's above that. So it is, unfortunately, one of the things that does occur when someone has a fairly aggressive type of disease, and sort of prevention of getting to that point is really where ablation plays a bigger role now in changing the curve of what we do.
Jerry, you know, that was a great question, but I have to tell you, Dr. Singh did mention the fact that earlier, I don't know if you were listening, that this kind of thing happens every once in a while. But, Jerry, thank you for the call. You really expanded on it, and I appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Paul in Westfield. Paul in Westfield, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. My question concerns a friend who has had their procedure and since having it has been successfully had a great loss of excess weight, but seems to be of the belief that increased alcohol intake and intoxication. constipation is not so much a problem, and I'm because of lesser absorption, or I'm not certain of how to consider the fallout of this. And I wanted to see if you would comment on that.
Sure, I'd be glad to. There's sort of two different things that happen. Is most people who had bariatric surgery, depending on which procedure they've had, they actually absorb alcohol much better and to higher degrees. So someone who's had a bypass actually absorbs alcohol almost like giving it to them intravenously. So one drink can be enough to make them intoxicated just after half of the drink. So the other thing that we see in people who've had weight loss surgery is that the issues of substance abuse or addiction come up, and a lot of times we change one addiction to another, whether it be smoking to eating, eating to drinking, all the things that occur with it. So there is an addictive issue that is always present that we need to sort of work through and make sure that doesn't happen. So we see transference of addictions from one to another, and that does affect someone's health. So drinking can not only cause problems with the surgery, leading to bleeding, ulcers, complications, but also lifestyle and potential injury to the person who involves in that behavior. So it's something we always want to screen out before, and also spend long-term follow-up with people to make sure they're not transferring that addiction or becoming having a problem with something that they didn't before.
Very interesting. Paul, any follow-up? Go ahead.
Sure, yes, if you don't mind. No. If that's very helpful, but my question sort of then goes to it, so that you'd say that because of the shorter gastric length, there is the absorption rate is increased.
Yes.
But so there's enhanced impact on other organs like liver, et cetera?
Well, the end-term effect on your liver and what may occur is unknown, and there's no long-term data of people who've been drinking after bariatric surgery to give us that type of information. The acute event of drinking, say, you know, instead of being diluted in your stomach and then slowly released in your intestinal tract, that alcohol is immediately getting into your intestinal tract and then immediately into your intravenous system. So now instead of having a blood alcohol level that's diluted out after hours, it's really high almost 5 minutes after drinking.
And there are calories.
Yep. And if you count the calories in it, it's a lot of liquid calories that are sort of wasted as you think about that.
That was a great call, Paul, from Westfield. Thanks again. Call again, will you?
Certainly.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to real fast to Ellen in Sand Lake. Okay, Ellen, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Your program is very timely because just last night, for the first time, I heard on the radio, not WAMC, an advertisement for a new medication that will fill up your stomach to such an extent. You take a little pill, and it expands hugely, apparently, and it goes into your stomach, and you won't feel the need to eat anything for, they say, 6 to 7 hours. Well, that all sounds very fine, except that I can't understand what happens after it leaves your stomach, or does it? I don't get it. Is this legitimate?
I'm not as familiar with that.
No, I've seen it on television, too.
Yeah. Really?
I know. Yeah. I tell you, Ellen, you know, this is unsolicited advice. I wouldn't do it.
Well, neither would I. Neither would I. Absolutely not. It's just that I'm wondering what happens. It must have to leave your stomach at some point, and does it shrink down? I guess it sounds like you guys don't necessarily know either.
That's right.
There is no medication or nothing at this point that we know about it. People do think about fiber and undigested material that do that. And there are some experimental drugs out there where people are looking at that swell in your stomach and then will make you feel full. But those drugs are now probably about 4 to 5 years at the earliest. The problem is once they swell in your stomach, they don't go down, so they end up stuck in your stomach, which leads to a problem. So that's why some of these medications that people are trying to develop from a pharmaceutical side are having hurdles and problems. So I'm not sure what you saw on TV is 100%.
Well, she was actually listening on the radio, but I have two suggestions. One, don't listen to anything else besides WAMC. And two, absolutely, you know, think 100 times before you do something like that.
No, I would never, ever do it.
No. And three, don't watch television in the middle of the night.
Oh, well, that I don't do either. So okay. I appreciate your help, though. Thanks for your thinking.
Bye-bye. Okay, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back. We got lots of free phones. 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Medical Associates of the Hudson Valley, Kingston. Physicians providing health care and primary care, infectious diseases, and more, in-office and hospital care, mahv.net. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, working to improve lives on the spectrum from 18 months to adulthood, diagnosis to graduation, andersoncares.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. Middletown Medical, with a walk-in urgent care center in Middletown with pediatricians available until 9 p.m. weeknights, minimal wait times, evening and weekend hours, middletownmedical.com. And Washington County Tourism, announcing the Washington County Fair August 19th through the 25th, spotlighting the county's agricultural heritage with exhibits, farm museum, and more, washingtonnycounty.com.
Well, we're back, and thank you, Zachary, for doing that. What makes Albany Med better or different from anything else that's doing this stuff?
Well, I think our program is different, and we've been sort of recognized since the first iteration for the American College that we are different in our level 1A designation. So that now goes back 7-8 years.
Is that as high as you can get, 1A?
That's the highest you can get.
Okay.
And so it is the program's been in existence since the mid-1990s. So this is a program now reaching its 20th year of existence, and I think that's longer than you'll see in most places in the Northeast.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So if so a place like NYU or one of those places, that's different?
I think we're different because we've had that structured program for years. We've had that commitment to lifelong care for the patient. Mm-hmm. Our outcomes are recognized that we have outcomes that exceed the national average for all the aspects that we look at. And so when we look at care of a patient, we're looking at medical management, surgical management, outcomes that are continued forever and with better outcomes than you would expect, say, from national numbers when you look at those statistics.
So what about all those people who tell you, come on, you don't want to go up here in Albany, you want to go to New York City or to Boston?
I think everyone wants to go wherever they think is best. But if you look at the level of care, you look at the commitment, you look at the outcomes, and you look at what you expect for what you get, I mean, you can go to New York City and have a bunch of things done. I'm not sure you go to New York City to get everything done that you need to have done when the care is better here.
Sure.
And same with Boston. So you can go lots of places, but should you go? That's a question you need to ask yourself. Where should you go to maximize your health long term? And I think the answer we always say is that our bariatric program will help you maximize that long term.
Okay, we'll go to Erica. I'll tell you where I'll go. Erica in Woodstock, New York. Erica, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Erica.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I had gastric bypass surgery about 15 years ago, and at Mount Sinai, and it was very successful for me. I did gain weight back. Everybody does, but it controlled my diabetes very successfully. However, now that I'm quite a bit older, I have very bad arthritis, and I really need to take ibuprofen. And I'm also taking Prilosec. So I'm wondering if it's safe to take ibuprofen as long as you're also on Prilosec. I really need an NSAID for the arthritis.
Well, Erica, there's a couple issues. One, losing weight and keeping it off is something you can do. And if you have gained weight, there are ways that we can tweak that so you can get your weight back down where you want to. So we have medical management and new surgical options to help you get your weight back down, because most people who've
had... What kind of surgical options?
There's a variety of different surgical options. First, we have to figure out what the issue is and what has happened to make you gain your weight back. And then we have ways to sort of change that playing field so you can get your weight back down.
You sound like you're being a little cagey here, Doctor, what some of the options are.
I think the options are multiple, and there's going back to surgery again versus doing through an endoscope, versus medical management. So, I mean, I could spend an hour just talking about that if you wanted me to, but I think I'd bore you with some
of
that.
But I have a great idea. When we're done with this, at some point you'll come in and you and I will just sit down and talk about the whole thing for an hour.
Absolutely.
Okay? So Erica.
I gained weight after I broke my hip and I couldn't move for a year. Yeah. Until that was 10 years I kept it off.
Well, that's great. Ten years is good.
The answer about ibuprofen. The answer about
ibuprofen.
The ibuprofen issue is always there, and we can't tell you it's safe to take ibuprofen, because just like alcohol, it sits within that pouch and causes ulcerations. So it can lead to ulcerations and perforation. So even if you are taking Prilosec, there is no guarantee that it may not cause a further problem. So we recommend all our patients not to take any of the non-steroidals sort of forever. And that's one of the commitments we ask them before surgery to think about, is that you can't take this forever and you have to come up with alternative treatments, because there is the lifelong risk. And it could be that you're fine one day and the next day you have bleeding and a bleeding ulcer and you end up in an emergency room with a bigger problem.
Wow. Well, I didn't know when I had this surgery that I have such terrible arthritis. So.
Yep.
Right.
No, who knew?
Well, Erica, good luck to you. I mean, it sounds like you've got a bunch of balancing to do. Thanks very much.
Yes, I do. Okay, thanks.
Bye. Okay, and we'll go to Nina in Lenox, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Nina. You're on.
Oh, yeah. I have a question regarding a hiatal hernia I have developed. I'm 66. And I developed it probably about 10 years ago. Before that, I could eat anything, and I didn't even know what heartburn was. I finally went to a doctor and got an endoscopic, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't know. They went down there. I had to
endoscopy.
Swallow something.
Yeah, they put something down your throat and take a look around.
And I think I had to swallow some stuff first.
Mm-hmm.
There was two different things going on. And I took omeprazole for a few years, and that was great, but I did learn that it's bad for your bones. So I've got off it, and I'm pretty successful, depending on what I eat and when I eat, to avoid any symptoms. But the doctor did say I really should consider surgery because of the size of the opening now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Unfortunately, some people have large hiatal hernias, which they can blame their parents for.
My dad had it, too.
Yep.
Huge numbers of people have them, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
So
keeps you in business, doesn't it, Doctor?
It does, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, it's one of these anatomical issues that if our parents had picked better, we would probably be not having the same problem. So the issue becomes is your stomach can actually go up and out of your abdomen and into your chest and can cause a twist or a turn, and then it becomes a more significant issue. So if you do have a hiatal hernia that has that component to it, that's why your doctor is probably telling you to have something done. And most people who have the surgery, the most common comment they always tell me is, I wish I had done this 10 years ago.
But when it goes down, when your weight goes down, sometimes the hiatal hernia, which has come up through the sternum or whatever happens, goes back down, doesn't it?
To some degree. Some people have a much larger opening, so even if losing weight, their stomach will then naturally come up into their chest. So even with a weight reduction, they will have it. And it's a little different than just someone who has heartburn or Barrett's. It's a different entity or animal, as it were. And the treatments are a little bit different for what needs to be done. But it ends up that most people feel so much better that it's always a universal comment is, I wish I had done this 10 years ago.
But when it goes back and forth, it sometimes mimics a heart attack, doesn't it?
Sure does. And people come to the emergency room and they're worked up for 10,000 tests because they may have had chest pain and thought their heart was a problem.
Yeah. Nina, thank you for your wonderful question.
Can I ask one more?
You can. Go ahead.
Is there a point of no return when I could not have surgery? Can I just put this off?
No, like anyone else. I mean, like most people, it is. You can probably put it off, but it's easier and much easier on you if you repair it while it's smaller. When it's bigger, it becomes a little bit bigger recovery and a higher chance for recurrence.
Well, what about age?
Age is, less of an issue for something like this. I mean, I've operated on people in their early 90s with something like this who have significant problems with their stomach where that could cause a twist or an issue. So there are some medical necessities where this needs to be done, and there are some times where you can act earlier and not get to that medical necessity portion.
All good questions, Nina. Thank
you
for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's go to Lou. Hey, Lou, where are you calling from?
Pittsburgh.
And where's that?
Massachusetts.
Okay. Pittsburgh, Massachusetts.
I have a
Go ahead.
I have a prolapsed bladder, and I'm stage 2. I do not want surgery. I've done yoga. I'm semi an athlete. I'm in my early 60s. And what I cannot find on Google or any way to research it, and I just would like to know more of how I could find out more about this. I've seen 2 urologists in Manhattan. If I drink alcohol or too much coffee with not balancing how much water I intake, I get what I have called a sour bladder. And it's not the traditional burning bladder like often women are told about. And I can sometimes dilute it by drinking a lot of water. I don't know what the question is I'm asking you, but it seems to me like it would be not good to have this burning bladder daily.
Well, doctor, there you go. The question, I guess, is, A, is this in your area of expertise? And do you wish to answer this question?
Well, I'm going to tell you that I'm not an expert at it, nor would I try to stab at it. But I would tell you if you should seek, you know, a urologist and someone who does urogynecology or someone who does urodynamics as their specialty, to really talk to them about that. And there are some people at the medical center, and we could have you see them. Dr. Kimball, who's at the medical center, would be a person who could help you with something like this.
Okay. Lou, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Maggie in Grafton. Okay, Maggie in Grafton, you're on.
Hello. I'd like to make a comment. Dr. Singh performed gastric bypass on my husband and myself. Mine is 12 years old and my husband's is 11. And it probably definitely saved his life, and certainly it has enhanced my life. So we were well prepared. Many times it was frustrating because there's so many steps you have to go through before you can actually get to have the surgery. But in retrospect, it was the correct approach.
Maggie,
so
a satisfied customer, and we thank you for calling. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Maggie. Let's go to Barbara in Malta, New York. And we do have time for one or two more, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Barbara in Malta, go ahead.
Hi, I had lap band surgery performed about 4 years ago. I'm 65, I've always been very healthy, except I had sleep apnea. And because the lap band surgery did a nice job, I don't have sleep apnea anymore. Yeah, I had to lose about 30 pounds before they would do the lap band surgery. After the lap band surgery, I lost another 30, and now I'm a normal weight. I'm a 12 to 14 dress size. I would like to go down another 30 pounds, and I find it really hard to do that. And I don't know whether I should just accept where I'm at, or have the band tightened again. The problem with getting the fills is I tend to not hold my food very well, and I certainly don't want, I don't want to lose weight because I'm throwing up. I want to lose weight because I'm restricted. I've tried changing my choices. Is this sort of a plateau you hit, or can I go forward on this thing and keep trying to lose more weight? What do you think?
Well, I think that you've lost probably what would somewhat be expected for someone with a band. The average weight loss in the United States with a band is somewhere between about 45% to 55% of excess body weight.
Now, so I've done that.
So that's usually what people will get to. Now, that's the average. Now, can you be better than average or worse than average? Surely you can. And what you need to do is work on those other components like we talked about, diet, exercise, and lifestyle. And if you work on those 3 components, you can make that shift go whichever way you want to. I always tell people I'd write a book, but I can't because it's really calories in versus calories out.
And if there's another book. People have written that book already, and will continue to. Yeah.
Yep.
Think about this for a second. You don't eat sugar, and you don't eat anything white. You'll lose weight.
Yep.
I mean, I'm on one of those binges myself right now.
Yeah. Well, it just seems so the doctor's saying I've kind of lost what I'm supposed to lose, and I have been able to keep my weight within 10 pounds of my lowest weight, but it doesn't go down any further, so now I have to do other things.
Well, I don't know who helps you with your band, but you want to talk about which way your band should go, and sometimes the answer is the band should be loosened. You need to eat more protein, more fiber, and you need to increase your exercise, and if you do that, you will lose weight from there. So it is something you should follow up with whoever's been helping you manage your band so you can make those decisions in the right manner.
Barbara, I thank you for the call. I'm trying to get everybody in.
And, go ahead. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and let's go to, let's go to Catherine in the Berkshires. Catherine, you got about 2 minutes. Go ahead.
It'll take. I'm going to have an endoscopy.
Yeah.
And I just want to ask him what it is. I know the tube goes in my mouth. I hope I'll be sort of put out a little bit for that.
Oh, they do. They do. Believe me, they do. I can tell you before even the expert tells you. First of all,
I want him if I've only
got. Oh no, you know what? You're absolutely right. I apologize. Go ahead, doctor.
We'll let Alan give you the real first person's view of it afterwards. But endoscopy is a way to look at your stomach, and the way it's done is they usually give you a medication or a combination of medications to make you feel drowsy. You may not be completely asleep, and then while you are drowsy, they will place a tube through your mouth with a camera on it to look at the lining of your esophagus, your stomach, and the first portion of your intestine.
You'll feel good. Believe
me. All that.
So yeah, you wake up and you wake up.
Become
and you
a dope
great.
Addict.
No, but are they effective?
Well, the test is usually effective as long as they can see all the areas that they need to, and sometimes because of anatomy or other things, they may not be able to do that. But 99% of the time, that usually is very effective in finding the answer.
Okay, and then I'll be still sleepy because I have to bring somebody to drive.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, just for the day.
Right. No question about it. I've had it a lot, and I got to tell you, you have nothing to worry about. It's really
okay,
good.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So that's sort of it. I can't believe it. We're out of calls. We're here with a wonderful Dr. Singh. We are out of time, and I want to thank everyone who called in. You are all great, except for maybe one. I would also like to thank Dr. Paul Singh for joining us today. Our engineer has been Kimber Lipscomb and supervised by the wonderful Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Hannah Hohenstein-Flack, who is celebrating a birthday today. Happy birthday, Hannah. Wonderful. Everybody's applauding in the control room. Wonderful. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Now, let me just say that if you have a question, Dr. Singh, how can they get their question answered?
They can actually either call to the medical center or through the website at the medical center to get information forwarded to us. You can look for our webpage on bariatrics. On the website, it'll be at AMC. And we'd be glad to either answer your call or get you back email about what your question may be.
Now, but if they want you, Paul Singh,
they will find me.
They'll find you.
They will find me.
One way or another.
Absolutely, everyone will find me.
Well, that's great. So Paul Singh has been with us. He's been terrific, and we certainly are going to invite him back because he was really good. I always like people who tell you what is right and, you know, and don't fool around. I mean, you know, you don't know an answer. You'd say you don't know an answer. You do. It's great. Okay, so Zach and you guys in the control room and Kimba, you can take it away and play us some theme and maybe a promo of some kind.